You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a collected works, volume 93, by Rudolf Steiner. 20 lectures entitled The Temple Legend, translated by John M. Wood. And this is the 20th and last lecture, entitled The Royal Art in a New Form, a lecture for a mixed audience of men and women, given in Berlin on the 2nd of January, 1906. I wish to speak to you today about something which is subject to many misunderstandings, and about which many extraordinary errors are spread abroad. Most of you know that I have already spoken on the same subject on the occasion of our general meeting this year, and that at that time, following an ancient occult practice, I spoke separately to men and to women. For specific reasons, which could probably become still clearer from the lecture itself, I have departed today from this ancient custom, and indeed because the very thing that motivated me both then and now to discuss this matter is connected with the hope that sooner or later, I hope sooner, this ancient custom will be abandoned altogether. I said that many misunderstandings have circulated about the subject. I need only mention one fact out of my own life to show you that it really is not exactly easy today to get beyond what are bluntly the bizarre and superstitious notions in existence about it. On the other hand, I need only say how easily, how unbelievably, one can put one's foot in it when dealing with these extraordinary facts. May I simply recall an incident in my life? Perhaps you will scarcely credit it, and yet it is true. It is now some 17 or 18 years ago that I was in company with university professors and some particularly gifted poets. Among the professors there were also some theologians from the theological faculty of the university in question. They were Catholics. Now in this company the following was said, not without foundation and in all seriousness, that one of these theologians, a very erudite man, would not go out at night any more because he believed that the Freemasons would be on the loose. The man in question represented a major department, but it was not he who told the story, it was told by a colleague. He went on to relate that while he was in Rome, a number of monks of a particular order, there would have been 11, 12, or 13 of them, had vouched on oath for the truth of the following event. In Paris, an eminent bishop had preached a sermon in which he had spoken of the terrible danger to the world of the order of Freemasons. After the sermon, a man came to him in the sacristy and said that he was a Freemason and could give the bishop a chance to witness a meeting of the lodge. The bishop assented, saying to himself, "I will, however, take some holy relics with me so that I am protected." Then a meeting place was arranged. The man in question led the bishop into the lodge, where a hiding place was pointed out to him, from which he could observe all that took place. He placed himself in position, held the holy relics in front of him, and waited for whatever would befall. What he then saw was related in the following way. I emphasize that some of those in the company thought it all rather doubtful at the time. The lodge was then opened. It bore in reality the name Satan's Lodge, though it had quite a different name in the outside world. Then a remarkable figure appeared. By ancient custom, how he knew this custom he did not relate, the figure did not walk. It is indeed well known that spirits do not walk, but glide, so many believe. This remarkable figure opened the session. The bishop would on no account divulge what happened next. It became too terrible. But he called upon the whole power of the relics, and there was a rumbling like thunder through all the rows of seats, the call resounding, "We are betrayed!" And the one who had opened the session disappeared. Briefly, a brilliant victory of episcopal powers over what was to be done, one supposes. This was discussed as a completely serious matter in the company. You can see from that there are people today, perhaps gentlemen more erudite than many others, well-known people, who nevertheless take the view that this sort of thing can happen in Freemasonry. Now, what happened was that in the mid-80s, a French book appeared, which represented the secrets of the Freemasons in a most gruesome way, making them certainly more gruesome than secret. This book particularly revealed how the Freemasons celebrated Black Mass. This book was a ploy by a French journalist called Leo Taxel. He stirred up a lot of dust by bringing in a Miss Vaughan as a witness. The result of all this was that the Church found the Freemasons and their nocturnal intrigues so dangerous that they felt it necessary to found a world society against Freemasonry. A kind of council was held in Trent. Although it was not a real council, it was dubbed, quote, the Second Council of Trent, close quote. It was attended by many bishops and hundreds of priests. A cardinal presided. The Congress became a major coup for Taxel, but afterward rebuttals were published, after which Mr. Taxel revealed that the entire contents of his books, including the people mentioned in them, were his own invention. You see, there are plenty of opportunities for incurring censure over such things. This was one of the worst cases of a body with a worldwide reputation doing so. From it, you have to draw at least one conclusion, that hardly anything is really known about the Freemasons. For if something was known about them, it would be easy to become informed, and then such rubbish could not gain currency. Indeed, this or that opinion about Freemasonry predominates in large sections of the public. Today, to be sure, it is not all that difficult to form an opinion, as there is already a tolerably abundant literature, written partly by those who have studied many documents, but in part also containing things which the Freemasons would say had been brought into the open by turncoats. Anyone who concerns himself to any extent with this literature will draw some sort of conclusion from what it deals with. However, one can rule out coming to a correct conclusion from it, since it is still preeminently true what Lessing, who was himself a Freemason, said when he was accepted. The worshipful master asked him, quote, "Now you see, don't you, that you have not been initiated into anything particularly subversive or anti-religious?" Close quote. To which Lessing replied, quote, "Yes, I must admit that I haven't learned any such thing. I would, in fact, have been glad to do so, for then at least I would have learned something." Close quote. That is the statement of a man who was able to consider the matter with the right understanding, and who admitted that he had learned precisely nothing from what took place there. You can at least draw the conclusion from that those who are not Freemasons know nothing about it, since even those who are Freemasons know nothing of any importance. They generally get the impression that they have gained nothing in particular from it, and yet it would be quite wrong to make such an inference. Now, there is still another opinion, which has little to do with real Freemasonry. In a text appearing in 1875, the author claims that Adam became the first Freemason. One can hardly go further back than the first man in searching for the founder of an association. Others claim that Freemasonry is an old Egyptian art, in short, that it is what is always been known as the, in quotes, royal art. And this is indeed placed by some in primeval times. Finally, many rites, for thus the symbolic ways and manners of the Freemasons are designated, bear Egyptian names. And so from these names you may infer that something deriving from ancient Egyptian culture is involved. At least the opinion is widely held, both in and out of Freemasonry, that it is something very ancient. Now, Freemasonry is something which can indeed provide people with scope for reflection. The name itself connects with two perceptions differing totally from each other. Some claim, and they are not a very great party within Freemasonry, that all Freemasonry originated in the work done by Masons, in the craft of erecting buildings, while the other opinion considers this to be a childish and naive conception, and claims that Freemasonry was in reality always an art to do with the soul, and that the symbols taken from the work of Masons, such as, for example, apron, hammer, trowel, chisel, compass, rule, square, plumb line, spirit level, etc., are to be seen as symbolic of soul development. Thus, by the expression Masonry, in quotes, is to be understood nothing else than the building of the inner person, the work on the perfection of self. If you talk with a Freemason today, you can then experience him telling you that it is a childish and naive outlook that believes that Freemasonry has ever had anything to do with the work that Masons do. On the contrary, it has never concerned itself with anything else than these things, the building of the Wonder Temple, which is the theater of the human soul, the work on the human soul itself, which has to be perfected, and the art which one must apply to all this. Now, all this is expressed in these symbols so as not to expose it to profane eyes. Looked at from our contemporary standpoint, both of these views are wholly and utterly wrong, and are so for the following reasons. As regards the first opinion, present-day man, in talking about the Freemasons having been derived from the work of building, no longer conceives himself to be as significant as he properly should. As for the second opinion, that the symbols are only there to serve as metaphors for the work on the soul, this opinion, even though it is regarded by most Freemasons as something quite irrefutable, is, when properly conceived, a nonsense. It is much more correct to link Freemasonry with the work of building, not indeed as architecture or construction are thought of today, but in a fundamentally deeper sense. Today, there are broadly two trends in Freemasonry. The one is represented by the great majority of those calling themselves Masons today. And this majority trend claims now that all Masonry is comprised of what is known as the so-called symbolic or craft Masonry. Its principal outward characteristic is that it is divided into 3 degrees, the apprentice, journeyman, and master degrees. As for the inward characteristics, we will have something to say presently. Apart from these craft Masons, there are still quite a number of Masons who maintain that craft Masonry is only a product of the decline of the great universal Masonic idea. They consider it would be a falling away from this great Masonic idea if it is claimed that Masonry comprises only these 3 symbolic or craft degrees, whereas in fact the essence, the fundamental meaning of Freemasonry, lies in the so-called higher degrees, which are best preserved in the so-called Scottish or accepted rite, which in a particular respect still conserves a relic of what is called the Egyptian, the Mizraim, or the Memphis rite. Thus we have 2 tendencies confronting each other, the craft Masonry and the higher degree Masonry. The craft Masons claim that the higher degrees are nothing but a frippery based on human vanity, which takes pleasure in having something special, something spiritually aristocratic, with its ascent from degree to degree and its pride in the possession of the 18th or 20th or still higher degree. Now, you have already become acquainted with quite a number of things likely to lead to misunderstandings. The higher degree Freemasonry can be traced back to the old mysteries, to the procedures which we have described and will describe in our theosophy as far as possible, procedures which have been in existence since primordial times and still exist today, and which have preserved the higher supersensible knowledge for mankind. This supersensible knowledge available to mankind was given to those who could gain access to the mystery schools by developing higher powers in themselves, enabling them to see into the spiritual world. Within these primordial mysteries, they have become something else nowadays, and we do not want to speak of that now. Within these primordial mysteries, they have become something else nowadays, and we do not want to speak of that now, was contained the original seed for all later spiritual culture. For what was enacted in these primordial mysteries was not what constitutes human culture today. If you wish to understand present-day culture and immerse yourself in it, you will find that it divides into three realms: the realm of wisdom, the realm of beauty, and the realm of strength. The whole extent of spiritual culture is in fact contained in these three words. Therefore, they are known as the three pillars of human culture. They are the same as the three kings in Goethe's fairy story of the green snake and the beautiful lily, the gold king, the silver king, and the brass king. This is connected with Freemasonry, being called the royal art. Today, these three realms are separated from each other. Wisdom is essentially contained in what we call science. Beauty is essentially embodied in what we call art. And what in Freemasonry terms is known as strength is contained in the regulated and organized living together of humanity in the state. The Freemason subsumes all this in the relation of the will to these three principles, wisdom, beauty, and strength. What they, these three principles, were to give to humanity was in primeval times bestowed on the candidate for initiation by the revelation of the mystery secrets. We are now looking back to a time when religion, science, and art had not yet become separated, but when they were still combined. In fact, to anyone who can see supersensibly, astrally, these three principles are not for him separate. Wisdom, beauty, and the domain of the will impulses are for him a single unity. On the higher realms of vision, there is no abstract science, only a science which exists in pictures, in that which has only a shadowy existence in the external world, and finds a shadowy expression in the imagination. What can now be read in the books, in this or that record of the creation, about the origin of the world and of humanity, was not described. Instead, it was brought before the eyes of the pupil in living pictures, in magnificent, harmonious color. And what the pupil would perceive as wisdom was art and beauty at the same time, was something which stirred his feelings to greater heights than we experience in front of an exquisite work of art. The yearning for truth and beauty, wisdom and art, and the religious impulse as well, all developed simultaneously. The artist's eye looked at what was enacted in the mysteries, EYE, and he who sought piety found the object of his religious ardor in these high events that were enacted before his eyes. Religion, art, and science were one. Then came the time when this unity split up into three cultural provinces, the time when the intellect went its own way. Science arose at the same time, and the mysteries which I have just described lost their importance. You know that Western philosophy and science proper, began with Thales. That is the time when it first developed out of the former fullness of the life of the mysteries. Then also began what in the Western sense is conceived of as art. For Greek dramatic art developed out of the mysteries. Whereas in India, up to the time of the Egyptian cult, One was concerned with the suffering and death of gods, with the great Greek tragedian poets such as Aeschylus, Sophocles, etc. We are dealing with individual human beings who are images of the great Godhead. Through these human beings, the pupils of the mysteries reconstructed the suffering, struggling, and needy Godhead, thus displaying God to the human audience through their human imagery. Whoever wants to understand what Aristotle meant by purification, catharsis, must interpret the concept by means of the astral, by means of the secrets of the mysteries. The expressions which he employs for tragedy, by way of explaining it, are a dim reflection of what the pupils learned in the mystery schools. Remember how Lessing investigated the soul forces of fear and compassion that are to be aroused through tragedy. That has furnished the material for many a great and learned discussion since the days of Lessing. For the mystery pupil, these emotions would be aroused in reality when God was portrayed to him in his passage through the world. The passions present deep in the human soul were thereby actually stirred up and drawn out, just as one induces a fever and brings it to its culmination. This led to purification so as to be able to proceed to rebirth. All this appeared in shadow images in the ancient Greek tragedies. Just as with science, so has art too, developed out of these ancient mysteries. It is to these ancient mysteries that the higher degree Freemasons trace back their origin. In their higher degrees, they have nothing else than an imitation of the higher degrees of the mysteries into which the mystery candidate was gradually initiated. Now, we can also understand why the craft Freemasons insist so much that there should be no more such higher degrees. Actually, the higher degrees have more or less lost their meaning in Freemasonry in recent centuries. What has taken place in civilization during recent centuries has been largely uninfluenced from this quarter. But there was a time when the great cultural impulses issued precisely from what Freemasonry should be. In order to understand this, we must look a little deeper into an age to which I have often referred here already, but now wish to mention in a Masonic context, that is, the 12th century of our European cultural development. At that time, occultism, appearing under a variety of names, played a much greater role in the contemporary culture than anyone could ever imagine today. But all these different names are no longer relevant today, and I will indeed explain why. By an example from Freemasonry itself, I will show you why these names contribute nothing essential to understanding the matter. What I am now about to relate, anyone can experience if they become an apprentice Freemason. And since these things are known, at least by name, I am able to speak about them. A customary practice is what is known as tiling. When the lodge is opened and the worshipful master has taken his seat and the outer guard is at his post, the first question of the worshipful master is, "Has the lodge been tiled?" Readers aside, spelled T-Y-L-E-D. I am pronouncing that tiled. End of readers aside. The number of Freemasons who understand what this expression means are probably very few. Since the matter is simple, I can indeed give you an explanation of the term. At the time of which I am speaking, to be a Freemason meant to stand in vehement opposition to everything that commanded outward official power. Therefore, it was necessary to conduct the affairs of the Freemasons with exceptionally great caution. Precisely for this reason, it was at that time necessary for Freemasonry to appear under various names that sounded harmless. Among other names, they called each other, quote, "brethren of the craft," close quote, and so on. Today, Freemasonry has accomplished a large part of what it then set out to do. Today, it is itself officially a power in the world. If you ask me what Freemasonry is really about, I must answer with abstract words. It consists in this, that its members aim to anticipate in thought by several centuries the events that are to occur in the world, and to perfect the high ideals of humanity in a fully conscious way, so that these ideals are not just abstract ideas. Today, when a Freemason talks about ideals and one asks him what he means by the highest ideals, he will say that the highest ideals are wisdom, beauty, and strength, which, however, on further consideration, is usually nothing but a form of words. If at that time, or now indeed, the discussion about these ideals is with someone who actually understands something about this, then the discussion will be about something quite specific, about something so specific that it relates to the course of events in the coming centuries in the same way as the thoughts of an architect building a factory relate to the factory when finished. At that time in the 12th century, it was dangerous to know in advance what was to happen later. Hence it was necessary to make use of harmless-sounding words as a cover. And that is also where the expression originated, quote, is the lodge tiled, close quote, which means in effect, quote, are only those present who know the meaning of the things which have to be implanted in the future development of mankind by Freemasonry, close quote. For each had to reflect that they must never let themselves be recognized as Freemasons when they appeared in public. This precautionary rule, then, essential, has been maintained until our time. Whether many Freemasons know what is meant thereby is questionable. Most think it is some sort of verbal formality, or they interpret it more or less astutely. I could give you countless more such examples that would show you how outer circumstances have led to the adoption of practical rules for which people now try to discover some deep symbolic explanation. But now, for the very heart of what was attempted in the 12th century. That is expressed in the deeply significant saga of the Holy Grail, of that enchanted vessel which is said to have come from the distant east and to have the power to rejuvenate people, to bring the dead back to life, and so on. Now, what is the Holy Grail in Freemasonry terms? And what is it that lies at the bottom of the whole saga? We shall best be able to understand what it is all about if we call to mind a symbol of certain Freemasonry associations, a symbol misunderstood today in the coarsest way imaginable. It is a symbol taken from sexual life. It is absolutely true that precisely one of the deepest secrets of Freemasonry has a symbol taken from sexual life, and that many people who try to explain such symbols today are only following their own sordid fantasies when they understand these symbols in an impure sense. It is very likely that the interpretation of these sexual symbols will play no small role in times to come, that it is precisely this which will then reveal the parlous state into which the great ancient secrets of Freemasonry have fallen today. And on the other hand, how necessary it is in the present time for the pure, noble, and profound basis of the Freemasonry symbols to be kept sacred and unblemished. Those of you who heard my recent lecture at the general meeting will know that the true original significance of these symbols is connected with the reason for not allowing women to become Freemasons until a short while ago, and the reason for addressing men and women separately on these matters until just recently. On the other hand, you also know that these symbols are linked, and I particularly stress this, with the two great streams running through the whole world and rising to the highest spiritual realm, which streams we also encounter as the law of polarity in the forces of male and female. Within that culture which we now have to consider, the priestly principle is expressed in Masonic terminology as the female principle in the spiritual realm. In that spiritual realm, which is most closely related to cultural evolution, the rule of the priests is expressed by the female principle. On the other hand, the male principle is everything which is opposed to this priestly rule. However, in such a way that this opponent has to be considered as the holiest, the noblest, the greatest, and the most spiritual principle in the world, no less. There are thus two streams with which we have to deal, a female and a male stream. The Freemasons see Abel as representing the female current, Cain the male. Here we come to the fundamental concept of Freemasonry, which, to be sure, is old, very old. Freemasonry developed in ancient times as the opponent of the priestly culture. We must now, however, make clear in the right way what is to be understood by priestly culture. What is involved here has nothing to do with petty opposition to churches or creeds. Priestliness can show itself in the most completely secular people. Even what manifests today as science that holds sway in many cultural groups is nothing else than what is known in Freemasonry terms as the priestly element, though there are other such groups which are profoundly Masonic. We must conceive such things, then, in their entire profundity, if we want to appraise them correctly. May I explain by an example how what manifests as science can often be what is denoted in Freemasonry as the priestly element. Who today among doctors would not scoff if I told about the healing properties of the spring at Lourdes? On the other hand, what doctor would not accept as a matter of course that it is wholly reasonable for certain people to go to Wiesbaden or Carlsbad? I know I am saying something fearfully heretical, but then I represent neither the priesthood nor even medicine. However, a time is already coming when an unbiased judgment will be pronounced on both. Were there an effective medicine today, faith in the power of healing would be among the things a doctor would prescribe. One patient would be sent to Carlsbad and another to Lourdes, but both for the same reason. Whether you call it great piety on the one hand or blatant superstition on the other, in the last analysis, it is the same thing. Understood in this way, we can characterize what underlies the priestly principle as refraining from investigating fundamentals, as accepting things as they present themselves from whatever aspect of the world, as being satisfied with what is thus given. The symbol of that for which man does nothing, the proper symbol for what is, in the truest sense of the word, donated to man, that symbol is taken from sexual life. The human being is indeed productive there, but what is manifested in this productive force has nothing to do with human art, with human science, or with human ability. From it is excluded everything which comes to be expressed in the three pillars of the royal art. So when some present these sexual symbols to humanity, they want to say, in this symbol human nature is expressed not as man has made it, but as it has been given by the gods. This finds its expression in Abel, the hunter and herdsman, who offers the sacrificial animal, the sacrificial lamb, thereby offering what he himself has done nothing to produce, which came into existence independently of him. What did Cain, on the other hand, offer? He sacrificed what he had obtained by his own labor, what he had won from the fruits of the earth by tilling the soil. What he sacrificed needed human skill, knowledge, and wisdom, that which demands comprehension of what one has done, which is based, in a spiritual sense, on the freedom of man to decide things for himself. That has to be paid for with guilt, by killing, first of all, the living things which had been given by nature or by divine powers, just as Cain killed Abel. Through guilt lies the path to freedom. Everything that is born into the world, upon which man can, at best, act only in a secondary way, everything given to man by divine powers, everything which is there without him needing to work at it incessantly, all this is given to us, first of all, in the kingdoms of nature, over which we have no control. In those kingdoms, the plant, animal, and human kingdoms, the forces of which are isolated from any human contribution, because in these kingdoms it is physical reproduction that is involved. All the reproductory forces in these kingdoms are given to us by nature. Inasmuch as we take what is living for our use, because we make the world our dwelling place, which was developed out of what is living, we thereby offer the sacrifice given to us, just as Abel offered the sacrifice given to him. The symbol for these three kingdoms is the cross. The lower beam symbolizes the plant kingdom, the middle or cross beam, the animal kingdom, and the upper beam, the human kingdom. The plant has its roots buried in the earth and directs upward in the blossom those parts which in man are directed downward. It is the reproductive organs of the plant that appear in the blossom. The downward turned part, the root, is the plant's head, buried in the earth. The animal is plant turned halfway and carries its backbone horizontally in relation to the earth. Man is the plant turned completely round, so that the lower part is directed upward. This view lies at the basis of all the mysteries of the cross. And when theosophy shows us how man has to pass, in the course of his evolution, through the various kingdoms of nature, through the plant, animal, and human kingdoms, then that is the same thing expressed by Plato in the beautiful words, quote, "The world soul is nailed to the cross of the world body." Close quote. The human soul is a spark struck from the world soul, and the human being as physical human being is plant, animal, and physical man at the same time. Inasmuch as the world soul has divided itself up into the individual sparks of human souls, it is, as it were, nailed to the world cross, nailed to what is expressed in the three kingdoms, the animal, plant, and human kingdoms. Powers which man has not mastered are at work in these kingdoms. If he wants to control them, then he must create a new kingdom of his very own, which is not expressed in the cross. When talking about this subject, I am often asked, where is the mineral kingdom in all this? The mineral kingdom is not symbolized in the cross, because it is that kingdom in which man can already express himself in clear and blinding clarity, where he has learned to apply the techniques of weighing and calculating, of geometry and arithmetic. In short, everything pertaining to inorganic nature, to the inorganic mineral kingdom. If you contemplate a temple, you know that man has erected it with ruler, compasses, square, plumb line, and spirit level. And finally, with the thinking that inorganic nature has transmitted to the architect in geometry and mechanics. And as you continue your contemplation of the whole temple, you will find it to be an inanimate object, born out of human freedom and brain work. You cannot say that, however, if you subject a plant or an animal to human observation. So you see that what man has mastered, what he is able to master, is up to now the realm of the inanimate. And everything which the human being has converted to harmony and order out of the inanimate world is the symbol of his royal art on earth. What he has implanted into the mineral kingdom with his royal art started as an outflow, an incarnation of divine wisdom. Go back to the time of the ancient Chaldeans and Egyptians, when it was not only the intellect that was used in building, but when heightened perceptions permeated everything, the controlling of inorganic nature was then seen as the royal art, which is why the control of nature was denoted as free masonry. At first this may seem to be fantasy, but it is more than that. Picture to yourselves that instant, that point in time in our Earth's development, when no one had yet applied his hand to the shaping of inorganic nature, when the whole planet was presented to man just as it came from nature. And what happened then? Look back to the construction of the Egyptian pyramids, in which stone was fitted to stone through human agency. Nature's creation was given a new shape as a result of human thought. Human wisdom has thus transformed the earth. That was perceived as the proper mission of free constructing man on earth. Using a wide variety of tools, guided by human wisdom, human powers have brought about in the mineral world a transformation that has unfolded between primordial times and the present day, when human powers can extend their influence over far distances without mechanical means. And that is the first pillar, the pillar of wisdom. Somewhat later, we see the second pillar established, the pillar of beauty, of art. Art is likewise a means of pouring the human spirit into lifeless matter. And again, the result is an ensoulment, conquest, in quote, in parentheses, of the inanimate to be found in nature. Try for a moment to picture in your mind how the wisdom in art gradually overcomes and masters lifeless nature. And you will see how what it is there without man's participation is reshaped piece by piece by man himself. Visualize, as a fantasy if you must, the effect of the whole earth having been transformed by the hand of man, the effect of the whole earth becoming a work of art, full of wisdom and radiating beauty, built by man's hand, conceived by man's wisdom. It may seem fantastic, but it is more than that. For it is humanity's mission on earth to transform the planet artistically. You find this expressed in the second pillar, the pillar of beauty, to which you can add as the third pillar the reshaping of the human race in national and state life. And you have the propagation of the human spirit in the world. You have this right here in the realm of what is lifeless. Hence the medieval people of the 12th century reflected, in looking back to the ancient wisdom, that the wisdom of times past was preserved in marble monuments, while contemporary wisdom is to be found in the human heart. For it is manifested through the artist, becoming a work of art through the labor of his hands. What he feels he impresses into matter that is unformed, he chisels out of the dead stone, while the inner soul of man does not, of course, live in this dead stone. It does manifest itself there. All art is dedicated to this purpose. There is always this mastering of unliving, inorganic nature, regardless of whether it is a sculptor chiseling marble or a painter arranging color, light, and shade. And even the statesman gives structure to nature. In brackets, there's a question here, readers aside, end of readers aside. Always apart from when plant, animal, or human forces come into it, you are dealing with man's own spirit. Thus, the medieval thinker of the 12th century looked back at the occult wisdom of the ancient Chaldeans, at Greek art and beauty, and at the strength in the concept of the state in the Roman Empire. These are the three great pillars of world history: wisdom, beauty, and strength. Goethe portrayed them in his fairy story as the three kings: occult wisdom in the gold king, beauty as in Greece in the silver king, and in the brass king, strength as it found world historical expression in the Roman concept of the state, and as then adopted in the organization of the Christian church. And the Middle Ages, with its chaos resulting from the impact of the migrating nations, and with its mixed styles, is expressed in the misshapen mixed king made of gold, silver, and brass, What was kept separate in the various ancient cultures is mixed together in him. Later, the separate forces must once more develop out of this chaos to a higher level. All those who in the Middle Ages took the Holy Grail as their symbol set themselves the task of using human powers to bring these separate forces to a higher stage of development. The Holy Grail was to have been something essentially new, even though it is closely related in its own symbolism to the symbols of a very ancient mystical tradition. What then is the Holy Grail? For those who understand this legend correctly, it signifies, as can even be proved by literary means, the following. Till now, man has only mastered the inanimate in nature, the transformation of the living forces, the transformation of what sprouts and grows in the plants, and of what manifests itself in animal and human reproduction. That is beyond his power. Man is to leave these mysterious powers of nature untouched. There he cannot encroach. What results from these forces cannot be fully comprehended by him. An artist can certainly create a strangely beautiful Zeus, but he cannot fully comprehend this Zeus. In the future, man will reach a level where he can do that as well. In the same way that man has achieved control over inanimate nature, has mastered gravity with spirit level and plumb line, and the directional forces of nature with the aid of geometry and mechanics, so it is the case that in future man will himself control what he only receives as a gift from nature or the divine powers, namely the living. When in the past Abel sacrificed what he had been given by divine hand, he was thus sacrificing in the realm of the living only what he had received from nature. Cain, by contrast, had offered something which he had himself won from the earth by his own labor as the fruits of effort. Hence, at this time in the Middle Ages, a radically new impulse was introduced into Freemasonry. And this impulse is that denoted by the symbol of the Holy Grail, the power of self-sacrifice. I have often said, harmony in human relationships is not brought about by preaching it, but by creating it. Once the necessary forces have been awakened in human nature, there is no more unbrotherliness. The concepts of majority and minority are meaningless insofar as what the Masonic symbols express. In it there can be no contention, for it is only a matter of can or cannot. No majority can decide whether one should use a plumb line or a spirit level. The facts must decide that. In that all men are brothers, there they find themselves to be at one. On that there can be no contention. If everyone treads the path of objectivity, the path which entails the acquisition of higher powers. Thus the bond of the Freemasons is, without doubt, a bond of brotherhood, which in the broadest sense depends on what men have in common in inanimate nature. However, not every power is still available there. Some things which were once there have disappeared again, because in the cycle of nature in which we now find ourselves, and which we call Earth, it is material perception which is to the fore, while intuitive perception has been lost. I should like to indicate just one case. In architecture, the ability to design a really acoustic building has been completely lost. Yet in the past, this art was understood. Whoever puts a building together by outward concepts alone will never create something acoustically sound. But anyone who thinks intuitively, with his thoughts rooted in higher realms, will be enabled to accomplish a building with these properties. Those who know that also know that in the future those forces of outward nature, over which we have no control at present, must be conquered, just as man has already conquered gravity, light, and electricity in inanimate nature. Although our age is not yet so advanced as to be able to control outwardly living nature, although that cultural epoch has not yet come in which living and life-giving forces come to be mastered. Nevertheless, there is already the preparatory school for this, which was founded by the movement called the Lodge of the Holy Grail. The time will, however, come, and it will be quite a specific point in time, when humanity, deviating from its present tendency, will see that deep inward soul forces cannot be decided by majority resolutions, that no vote can settle questions involving the limitless realm of love, involving what one feels or senses. That force which is common to all mankind, which is expressed in the intellect as an all-embracing unity about which there can be no conflict, is called manas. And when men have progressed so far that they are not only at one in their intellect, but also in their perceptions and feelings, and are in harmony in their inmost souls, so far that they find themselves in what is noble and good, so far that they lovingly join together in the objective, in what they have in common, in the same way that they agree that 2 times 2 makes 4 and 3 times 3 equals 9, then the time will have arrived when men will be able to control the living as well. Unanimity, objective unanimity in perception and feeling, with all humanity really embracing in love, such is the precondition for gaining control over the living. Those who founded the movement of the Holy Grail in the 12th century said that this control over living nature was at one time available to the gods who created the cosmos and descended to earth in order to give mankind the germ of the capacity for the same divine forces that they already possess themselves, so that man is now on the way to becoming a god, having something in his inner being that strives upward toward where the gods once stood. Today, the understanding, the intellect, is the predominant force. In the future, it will be love, buddhi, and in a still more distant future, man will attain to the stage of atma. This joint force, in parentheses, communal force, which gives man power over what is symbolized by the cross, is expressed, as far as the gods' use of the force is concerned, by a symbol, namely by a triangle with its apex pointing downward. And when it is a matter of this force being expressed in man's nature, as it germinally strives upward toward the divine force, then it is symbolized by a triangle with its apex pointing upward. The gods have lifted themselves out from man's nature and have withdrawn from him, but they have left the triangle behind with him, which will develop further within him. This triangle is also the symbol of the Holy Grail. The force as in the gods, the force as in men. So here we have a triangle above pointing down and below pointing up. And then to the right of that is the two combined in a Jewish star. And to the right of that it says, the symbol of the Holy Grail. The medieval occultist expressed the symbol of the Grail, the symbol for awakening perfection in the living, in the form of a triangle. That does not need a communal church, entwining itself around the planet in a rigid organization, though this can well give something to the individual soul. But if all souls are to strike the same note, then the power of the Holy Grail must be awakened in each individual. Whoever wants to awaken the power of the Grail in himself will gain nothing by asking the powers of the official church whether they can perhaps tell him something. Rather, he should awaken this power in himself, and should not question all that much. Man starts from dullness of mind, and progresses through doubt to strength. This pilgrimage of the soul is expressed in the person of Parzival, who seeks the Holy Grail. This is one of the manifold deeper meanings of the figure of Parzival. Does it further my knowledge if a corporate body, be they ever so great, proclaims mathematical truth through its official spokesman? If I want to learn mathematics, I must occupy myself with it and gain an understanding of it for myself. And of what use is it if a corporate body possesses the power of the cross? If I want to make use of the power of the cross, the control of what is living, then I must achieve this myself. No one else can tell it to me or communicate it through words. At best, they can show it to me in the symbol. Give me the shining symbol of the Grail, but it cannot be told in an intellectual formula. The first accomplishment of this medieval occultism would have been, consequently, would appeared in so many different movements in Europe, the striving for individuality in religion, the escape from the rigid uniformity of the organized church. You can barely grasp to what extent this tendency underlies Wolfram von Eschenbach's titled Parsifal. What is manifested for the first time in the Reformation was already inherent in the symbol of the Holy Grail. Whoever has a feeling for the great meaning of what can confront us in this symbolism will understand its great and deep cultural value. The great things of the world are not born in noise and tumult, but in intimacy and stillness. Mankind is not brought forward in its development by the thunder of cannons, but through the strength of what is born in the intimacy of such secret brotherhoods, through the strength of what is expressed in such world-embracing symbols, which inspire mankind. Since that time, through innumerable channels, the hearts of men have received as an inflow what was conceived by those who were initiated into the mysteries of the Holy Grail in the middle of the 12th century, who had to hide from the world under pseudonyms, but who were really the leaven preparing the culture of the last 400 years. The guardians of great secrets, of those forces which continually influence human developments, live in the occult brotherhoods. I can only hint at what is really involved, because the matter itself goes very deeply into the occult realm. For those who really gain access to such mysteries, one practical result is a clearer perspective of world happenings in the future. Slowly but surely, the organic, the living forces intervene in the present-day cycle of humanity's development. There will come a time, however fantastic this might seem to contemporary people, when man will no longer paint only pictures, will no longer make only lifeless sculptures, but will be in a position to breathe life into what he now merely paints, merely forms with colors or with a chisel. However, what will appear less fantastic is the fact that today the first dawn is already beginning for the use of these living forces in the affairs of social life. That is the real secret surrounding the Grail. The last event brought about in the social sphere by the old Freemasonry was the French Revolution, in which the basic idea of the old Freemasonry came into the open in the social sphere, with the ideas of equality, liberty, and fraternity as its corollaries. Whoever knows this also knows that the ideas which emanated from the Grail were propagated through innumerable channels and constituted the really active force in the French Revolution. What is today called socialism exists only as an abortive and impossible experiment, as a final, I may say, desperate struggle in a receding wave of humanity's development. It cannot bring about any really positive result. What it sets out to achieve can only be achieved through living activity. The pillar of strength is not enough. Socialism can no longer be controlled with inanimate forces. The ideas of the French Revolution, liberty, equality, fraternity, were the last ideas to flow out of the inanimate. Everything that still runs on that track is fruitless and doomed to die. For the great evil existing in the world today, the dreadful misery which expresses itself with such frightful force, which is called the social question, can no longer be controlled by the inanimate A royal art is needed for that. And it is this royal art which was inaugurated in the symbol of the Holy Grail. Through this royal art, man must acquire control over something similar to the force that sprouts in the plant. The same force that the occultist uses when he accelerates the growth of a plant in front of him. In a similar way, a part of this force must be used for social salvation. This power, which is described by those who know something of the Rosicrucian mysteries, as for example did Bulwer Lytton in his futuristic novel Vril, readers aside spelled V-R-I-L, end of readers aside, is at present still in an elementary germinal stage. In the Freemasonry of the future, it will be the real content of the higher degrees. The royal art will, in the future, be a social art. Again, I have to tell you something which will seem fantastic to the uninitiated, on account, I may say, of the comprehensive, all-embracing range of the idea. When man prints as a form, deriving from his soul, on the matter of this earth round, is eternal. It will not pass away. Even though the matter thus given form outwardly decays, what the royal art has given form to, in pyramids, temples, and churches, is imperishable. What the human spirit has given shape to in matter will remain present in the world as a continuing force. That is completely clear to those who are initiated in such matters. Cologne's Gothic cathedral will, for example, pass away, but it is of far-reaching significance that the atoms were once in this form. This form itself is the imperishable thing that will henceforth participate in the ongoing evolutionary process of humanity, just as the living force that is in the plant participates in the evolution of nature. The painter who paints a picture today, who prints dead matter with his soul's blood, is also creating something, which will sooner or later be dispersed in thousands of atoms. What has imperishable and continuing value, what is eternal, is that he has created, that something from his soul has flowed into matter. States and all other human communities come and go before our eyes. But what men have formed out of their souls as such communities constitute humanly conceived ideas of eternal value with an eternally enduring significance. And when this human race once again appears on the earth in a new form, then it will see the fruits of these elements of eternal value. Today, whoever turns his gaze upward to the starry heavens sees a wonderful harmony. This harmony has evolved. It was not always there. When we build a cathedral, we place stone upon stone. When we paint a picture, we place color next to color. When we organize a community, we make law upon law. In exactly the same way, creative beings once worked upon what confronts us today as the cosmos. Neither moon nor sun would shine, no animal, no plant would reproduce itself, unless everything we face in the cosmos had been worked upon by beings, unless there were such beings who worked as we work today on the remodeling of the cosmos. Just as we work on the cosmos today through wisdom, beauty, and strength, so too did beings who do not belong to our present human kingdom once work on the cosmos. Any harmony is always the outcome of the disharmony of an earlier time. Just as stones were given form for a Greek temple, just as they abounded in other forms, in a perplexing variety of forms, out of which they became a coordinated structure, just as the profusion of colors on the palette is meaningfully arrayed in a picture, so, in just the same way, all matter was in other chaotic relationships before the creating spirit transformed it into this cosmos. The same thing is recapitulated on a new level. And only he who sees the whole can work on the details correctly and clearly. everything that has had real significance for humanity's progress in the world has been brought about with care and judgment and through initiation into the great laws of the world plan. What the day produces is ephemeral. What is created in the day through knowledge of the eternal laws is, however, imperishable. To create in the day through knowledge of the eternal laws is the same thing as Freemasonry. Thus you see that what confronts us in art, science, and religion, beyond what is given by the gods and expressed in the symbol of the cross, is in fact brought about by Freemasonry, from which everything that has been properly built in the world derives. Freemasonry is thus intimately involved in everything that human hand has shaped in the world, with everything that culture has created out of raw, inanimate matter. Go back to the great things the cultural epochs have produced. Consider, for example, the poems of Homer. What is contained in them? What the initiates have taught mankind in great world-embracing ideas. The great artists did not invent their topics, but rather gave form to what embraces all humanity. Is a Michelangelo conceivable without the power of Christian concepts? Try in the same way to trace back to its origin whatever has achieved a really incisive cultural meaning, and you will in every case be led back to what has come from initiation in the mysteries. Everything must in the end undergo a schooling. The last 400 years were in fact a schooling for humanity, the school of godlessness, in which there was purely human experimentation. A return to chaos if seen from a particular point of view. Everyone is experimenting today without being aware of the connection with higher worlds, apart from those who have once more sought and found that connection with spiritual realms. Nearly everyone lives entirely for himself today, without perceiving anything of the real and all-penetrating common design. That, of course, is the cause of the dreadful dissatisfaction everywhere. What we need is a renewal of the Grail chivalry in a modern form. Anyone who can approach this will thereby come to know the real forces that today are still lying hidden in the course of human evolution. Today, so many people take up the old symbols without understanding them. What is thus made out of the sexual symbols in an uncomprehending way comes nowhere near to a correct understanding of Masonic concepts. Such understanding is to be sought in precisely those things that redeem mere natural forces. In penetrating and mastering what is living in the same way that the geometrician penetrates and masters the inanimate with his rule, compasses, spirit level, and so forth. And in working upon the living in the same way, those who build a temple put the unliving stones together. That is the great Masonic concept of the future. There is a very ancient symbol in Freemasonry, the so-called Tau. There's a picture. This Tau sign plays a major role in Freemasonry. It is basically nothing else than a cross from which the upper arm has been taken away. The mineral kingdom is excluded in order to obtain the cross at all. Man already controls that. If one lets the plant kingdom come into play, then one obtains the cross directed upward. What unfolds from the earth, from the soul, as power over the earth, is the symbol of future Freemasonry. Readers aside, the top symbol was like a capital T, and the bottom symbol was a capital T upside down. End of readers aside. Whoever heard my last lecture about Freemasonry will remember my telling you about the Freemasonry legend of Hiram Abiff, and how at a particular point he makes use of the Tau sign when the Queen of Sheba wanted him to call together once more the workers engaged in building the temple. Now, the people working together in social partnership would never appear at Solomon's command, But at the signal of the Tao, which Hiram Abiff raised aloft, they all appeared from all sides. The Tao sign symbolizes a totally new power based on freedom and consisting in the awakening of a new natural force. May I be allowed to resume at the remark with which I ended last time, when I told you where such great control over inanimate nature leads? Without much fantasy, one can show what is involved by an example. Wireless telegraphy works across a distance from the transmitting station to the receiving station. The apparatus can be set to work at will. It is effective over great distances, and one can make oneself understood by it. A similar force to that by which wireless telegraphy works will be at man's disposal in a future age, without even any apparatus. This will make it possible to cause great devastation over long distances, without anyone being able to discover where the disturbance originated. Then, however, when the high point of this development has been reached, it will eventually come to the point where it falls back on itself. On the other hand, what is expressed by the Tao is a driving force that can only be set in motion by the power of selfless love. It will be possible to use this power to drive machines, which will, however, cease to function if egoistical people make use of them. It is perhaps known to you that Keeley invented a motor that would only go if he himself were present. He was not deceiving people about this, for he had in him that driving force originating in the soul that can set machines in motion. A driving force which can only be moral, that is the idea of the future, a most important force, with which culture must be inoculated if it is not to fall back on itself. The mechanical and the moral must interpenetrate each other, because the mechanical is nothing without the moral. Today we stand hard on this frontier. In the future, machines will be driven not only by water and steam, but by spiritual force, by spiritual morality. This power is symbolized by the Tao sign, and was indeed poetically symbolized by the image of the Holy Grail. Man is no longer merely dependent on what nature will freely give him to use. He can shape and transform nature. He has become the master craftsman of the inanimate. In the same way, he will become the master craftsman of what is living. As something that must be conquered, the old sexual symbol stands at the turning point of Freemasonry. You could compare the old sexual symbol of the Freemasons with the new symbolism for future Freemasonry by the analogy of placing a rock struck from a cliff face and covered with rough grass next to a beautifully worked statue by a sculptor. Those who have been to some extent initiated into the royal art have been aware of this. Goethe, for instance, has expressed this marvelously in the homunculus episode in the second part of Faust. There are still many mysteries in that work which remain to be revealed. All this indicates that humanity faces a new epoch in the development of the occult royal art. Those who officially represent Freemasonry today know the least about what this future Freemasonry will be. They are the least aware that something quite new will replace the old symbols they have so often misinterpreted, and that this will have an entirely new significance. Just as it is true that everything of real importance in the past stems from the royal art, so it is also true that everything of real importance in the future will derive from the cultivation of the same source. Certainly every schoolboy today can demonstrate the theorem of Pythagoras. Only Pythagoras could discover it, because he was a master in the royal art. It will be the same in the royal art of the future. Thus you see that the Masonic art stands at a turning point in its development, and as the closest links with the work of the Lodge of the Grail, with what can appear as salvation in the dreadful conflicts all around us. These conflicts are only beginning. Humanity is unaware that it is dancing on a volcano, but it is so. The revolutions beginning on our earth make a new phase of the royal art necessary. Those people who do not drift thoughtlessly through life will know what they have to do, that they have to participate in our earth's evolution. Therefore, from a certain point of view, this very ancient royal art must be represented in a new form, to stand alongside of what is so ancient, in which there lies an inexhaustible force. Those who can grasp the new Masonic ideas will strike new sparks from Freemasonry's ancient symbols. Then it will also become plain that contention between craft and higher degree Freemasonry is meaningless, set against the endeavors of real Freemasonry. For this it is necessary to answer the question, and that brings us back to our starting point, quote, what was the royal art up till now? Close quote. The royal art was the soul of our culture, and this culture of ours has two basic ingredients. On the one hand, it is built up by those forces in the human soul that concern themselves with the inanimate. And on the other hand, by the forces of those people who make it their principal task to control the inanimate simply by means of the forces summoned up by their organism. And they are the men, hence the royal art has hitherto been a male art. Women were therefore excluded and could not take part in it. The tasks carried on in the lodges were set apart, kept separate, the details do not matter, from everything related to the family or to the reproduction on the purely natural basis of the human race. In Freemasonry, a double life was led. The great ideas which came to expression in the lodges were not to be mixed up with anything connected with the family. The work in the lodges, being related to the inmost life of the soul, ran parallel to nurturing the social life of the family. The one current lay in conflict with the other. The women were excluded from Freemasonry. This ceased the instant that Freemasonry stopped looking backward and turned its gaze forward. For it was precisely what flowed in from outside, bracketed question mark, that was seen as the female current. The Freemasons considered what came from nature as something priestly, and hitherto Freemasonry had regarded that as hostile. Man is, by his nature, the representative of the force that works on the inanimate, whereas the woman is seen as the representative of the living creative force that continually develops the human race on the basis of nature. This antithesis must be resolved. What has to be achieved in the future can only be brought about by overcoming everything in the world that relies upon the old symbols, which are expressed precisely in what is sexual. The Freemasonry that is obsolete today has these symbols, but is also aware of the fact that we must overcome them. However, these sexual symbols must be kept in existence outside in the institutions that relate to what is natural, and only in separation can the matter be resolved. Neither the architect, nor the artist, nor the statesman have anything to do, in their way of thinking, that is, I ask you to consider that, with the basis of sexuality in nature. They all labor to control inanimate forces with reason, with the intellect, that is expressed in the Masonic symbols. Overcoming this basis in nature in the far future, gaining control of the forces of life, as in the far-off times of the Lemurian race, man started to gain control of inanimate forces, that will be expressed in new symbols. Then the natural basis will have been conquered not only in the sphere of the inanimate, but also in the sphere of the animate. When we reflect on this, then the old sexual symbols appear to us as precisely what has to be overcome, in the broadest sense. And then we discover what in the future must be the creative and truly effective principle in the concept of uniting both male and female spiritual forces. The outward manifestation of this progress in Freemasonry is therefore the admission of the female sex. There is a meaningful custom in Freemasonry which relates to this matter. Everyone inducted into the lodge is given two pairs of gloves. He puts one pair on himself, the other pair is to be put on the lady of his choice. By this is signified that the pair should only touch each other with gloves on, so that sensual impulses should have nothing to do with what applies to Freemasonry. This thought is also expressed in another symbol. The apron is the symbol for the overcoming of sexuality, which is covered by the apron. Those who do not know about this profound Masonic idea will be unable to have any inkling of what the apron really means. One cannot bring the apron into line with Freemasonry in the narrow sense. We thus have the conquest of the natural by the free creative spirit on the one hand, but the separation by means of the gloves on the other. However, we could even take the gloves off in the end, once what is lower has been conquered by applying the immediate free spiritual forces of both sexes. Then only will what manifests itself today in sexuality be finally overcome. When human creation is free, completely free, when man and woman work together on the great structure of humanity, the gloves will no longer be distributed, for man and woman will be freely able to stretch out their hands to each other, because then spirit will be speaking to spirit, not sensuality to sensuality. That is the great idea of the future. If anyone today wants to enter the ancient Freemasonry, then he will only be at the zenith of Masonic thinking about the future shape of mankind, if he works in this spirit, and if he understands what the times demand of us, regardless of what the order was in antiquity. If it becomes possible to gain an understanding of what is called the secret of the royal art, then the future will undoubtedly bring us the rebirth of the old good and splendid Freemasonry, however decadent it is today. One of the ways in which occultism will permeate humanity will be through a revival of Freemasonry. The very best things reveal themselves precisely through the faults of their own virtues. And although we can only look upon Freemasonry today as a caricature of the great royal art, we must nevertheless not lose heart in our endeavor to awaken its slumbering forces again, a task which is incumbent on us, and which runs in a parallel direction to the Theosophical movement. So long as we do not dabble in the question which weighs upon us, but really grapple with it out of the depths of our understanding of world events, make ourselves understand what is becoming manifest in the souls of the sexes, in the battle of the sexes, then we will see that it out of these forces that the formative powers of the future must flow. We will see that it is out of these forces that the formative powers of the future must flow. All today's chatter is nothing. These questions cannot be answered unless the answer is drawn out of the depths. What exists in the world today as the social question or the question of woman is nothing unless it is understood out of the depths of world forces and brought into harmony with them. Just as it is true that the great deeds of the past had their origin in Freemasonry, so is it also true that the great practical deeds of the future will be gained from the depths of future Masonic ideas. That is the end of Lecture 20. There is now this small addendum entitled Goethe and his connection with Rosicrucianism, and then that will be the end of the book. There are two ways of penetrating Goethe's Rosicrucian mystery, an exoteric way and an esoteric or an occult way. The esoteric path is revealed through a study of those poems of his which are an outward expression of his Rosicrucian views and other knowledge relevant to this question. These include, 1, the poem Geheimnisse, the Mysteries, This describes the mystery of the logic 12, with the 13th at their head. The contents are a reference to experiences in the outer court of the Rosicrucian Parsifal initiation, Grail initiation. Number 2, the basic theme in Faust. Homunculus is the astral body. The journey to the, in quotes, mothers is a representation of the search for the golden triangle and the lost word. Number 3, the passages entitled Wilhelm Meister, portraying the, in quotes, journey and transformation of the soul, as far as the extension of consciousness to cosmic vision, parenthesis contemplation of cosmic events, Macarius's vision is such an act of contemplation, close parenthesis. Number 4, the fairy story of the green snake and the beautiful lily is a portrayal of an alchemistical initiation as established by Christian Rosenkreutz. This is written correctly, not as in the defective tradition of the lodges, as 030 degree, vulgarly known in Freemason parlance as the 30th degree. This fable contains in symbolic language all the secrets of this degree, just as the myth of Hercules contains all the myths of the royal arch degree, which is properly written 013 degree, and which is also called the 4th degree. Number 5, important aspects of Rosicrucian initiation are also to be found in the poem titled Pandora. The means of penetrating Goethe's Rosicrucianism in an esoteric or occult way are given in the initiation of the true 020 degree, which, to conceal the secret, is also written as 63 degree, being read as 6 times 3 equals 18th degree. And there's Rosenkreutz, Croix, in parentheses there. In this it is shown in an occult way that Goethe underwent an initiation between his visits to Leipzig and Strasbourg, which only came to fruition in his life gradually, and which enabled him to fulfill a very particular Rosicrucian mission. No more about this can be written down. One could still say a little more about it verbally, and still more only in a true Rosicrucian lodge of the 6 times 3 or 18th degree. That is now the end of the book, The Temple Legend, by Rudolf Steiner, 20 lectures, translated by John M. Wood.